If you look at us as a species, we're not very impressive. What we're good at is forming complex social networks. The purpose of human sexuality, the function, is social. It's not reproductive.
Hi, I'm Thad Russell for Reason TV. Today I'm joined by Christopher Ryan. Christopher Ryan, with his wife Casilda Jaita, is the author of Sex at Dawn: How We Mate, Why We Stray, and What It Means for Modern Relationships. I'm interested in freedom. Many of our listeners and watchers are interested in freedom. What does your book offer to someone who wants more freedom in their lives?
Well, it offers a way to sort of fight their way out of socially imposed restrictions on, not so much on behavior necessarily, but on desires. It was Schopenhauer, I think, who said that man can control what he does, but not what he wants to do. And so a lot of our desires are very deeply ingrained in our evolutionary past, particularly the desire or the attraction to multiple people, which is one of the central points we make in the book. So if you're in a long-term relationship with someone that's sexually monogamous, but you're interested in other people, you're attracted to other people, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with your marriage necessarily or your relationship, or that there's anything wrong with you or your partner. So there are different levels of freedom, of course. There's freedom of action, but there's also freedom of thought and desire. And I think those are the sorts of freedoms that our book speaks to.
So marriage certainly is a central pillar in our culture. Everyone agrees on that. And monogamy, of course, is central to marriage, right? And there are something like 1,500 rights, benefits, and privileges granted to married couples that others don't get, right? Yeah. So it's really important in our culture, and it's enforced by the state. What is your thesis doing to that pillar?
Well, first it questions the premise that that sexual monogamy is central to marriage. We look at many different societies around the world that practice what anthropologists, in any case, call marriage, in which sexual monogamy is not essential aspect of that relationship. We look at societies in which property rights are not involved with marriage, in which assumptions of continuity or childcare or, you know, any of these other things that we associate with marriage, certainly property rights is a big part of marriage in our society. Now, anthropologists who say marriage is a human universal are applying this term to all sorts of relationships that really have no connection, no relationship with, or no resonance with our Western sense of marriage. There are societies in the Amazon, for example, that believe that an infant, or a fetus, I should say, is literally made of accumulated semen. And so women in these societies who want to have a child who is funny and smart and good-looking make sure they have sex with the funny guy and the smart guy and the good-looking guy, and then went to get the essence of each of these men into the fetus. And then when the child is born, each of these men will come forward and acknowledge their paternity. So even paternity is not a universally understood concept, much less what anthropologists and others are calling marriage.
Okay, so monogamy is not universal now. What is your evidence to demonstrate that monogamy has never been a universal?
Well, we look at four basic sources of information in the book. The anthropology is one of them. So we're looking at societies, particularly pre-agricultural societies, that presumably have a lot in common with our pre-agricultural ancestors because of the structural similarities that you find in pre-agricultural societies all around the world. We know our ancestors lived as nomadic hunter-gatherers until about 10,000 years ago at most, when agriculture first seems to have appeared in the Fertile Crescent. So that's one source of information. We also look at primates, particularly the primates closest to humans, chimps and bonobos. We look at the other apes as well, but try to focus on the primates that are most closely related to us. We look at human anatomy. Our bodies tell us a great deal about the way our ancestors behaved sexually. Our genitalia, the fact that we have external testicles, the fact that women are capable of multiple orgasm, whereas men aren't generally. And then we look at contemporary psychosexuality, the sorts of problems people have in long-term relationships, the sorts of fetishes or sexual issues that bring people to therapists. All these different sources of information converge on a vision of so-called natural human sexuality, or at least sexuality that is resonant with the way our ancestors lived. That is a pretty cohesive vision of the way we evolved.
Okay, let's start with bonobos. I didn't know what bonobos were until I read your book. So it sounds to me like bonobos can set us free. Why is that?
Well, Franz de Waal, who is one of the greatest living primatologists, who has written extensively on both bonobos and chimpanzees, said that chimpanzees use violence and power games to get sex, whereas bonobos use sex to avoid violence. So there are two very different approaches to social organization that sort of hinge on their relationship to sexuality. Now, what's interesting, people don't understand. People say, you know, someone who has a lot of sex, they say, well, you know, they're like animals. Actually, animals would be embarrassed by our behavior. Human beings have sex about 1,000 times per birth. The average among mammals is about 12 times per birth, right? So we're off the charts. There are very few animals, very few mammals particularly, that have sex when the female is not ovulating, right? Human beings have sex when the female's already pregnant, when she's menstruating, when she's lactating, when she's postmenopausal. We have oral sex, anal sex, all types of sex that can't possibly lead to conception. That's vanishingly rare among mammals. So the first thing to understand about human sexuality is that it's not primarily about reproduction, as counterintuitive as that may sound. The vast majority of our sexual interactions have nothing whatsoever to do. It's almost like reproduction is an occasional byproduct of human sexuality. Right. The purpose of human sexuality, the function, is social. It's not reproductive. And that's something that we have very deeply in common with bonobos. Bonobos use sex as a way, as a social lubricant, as a way to maintain equilibrium, as a way to avoid conflicts that would threaten the cohesion of the group. If all the males are having sex with females pretty much whenever anyone wants to, there's much less to fight about, right? Whereas the mainstream view of human evolution holds that we sort of evolved in these independent nuclear families where the man would go out and hunt and then bring home the dead deer and share it only with his wife and his children because he was concerned with his paternity. It turns out that's not the way hunter-gatherers live, and it certainly isn't the way our closest primate relatives live.
So I'm interested in social control, especially control of sexuality. So, I mean, in our culture, you know, generally speaking, we've been told that sex outside of marriage is bad, and the argument behind that is that sex is about reproduction, so that if you're not having reproductive sex, you're doing something that's essentially unnatural. And now it sounds to me like you're intervening there.
Yeah, that's bullshit. That there's no scientific credibility at all behind that statement. I know it's a very central statement to particularly the right wing vision of sexuality and certainly the Catholic Church's vision of sexuality. But if you have any understanding at all of the anthropological or primatological research, you see that's ridiculous. And also, just to interject quickly, that, you know, that's the kind of thinking that led to the war on masturbation, in which, you know, little girls were having carbolic acid poured onto their clitoris to stop them from touching themselves, and young boys were having their foreskin sewn together with you know, metal threads and stuff. This was early 20th century. This wasn't very long ago. Electroshock therapy to solve the problem of the sickness of homosexuality, which was happening as late as the 1960s and 70s. So that idea that sex is only for reproduction leaves out the vast majority of the things we do either alone or with other people sexually. You know, we use the word promiscuity in our book, but we're very careful to explain that we use it in the original sense. The roots of the word mean to mix. And we argue that our ancestors were promiscuous in the sense that they very likely had several ongoing sexual relationships at any given point in their adult lives. But we're not using it in the modern sense, where our ancestors certainly weren't having sex with strangers. Why? There were no strangers, right? our ancestors lived in very intimate bands with no more than 150 people. We can talk about how we know that number. It's Dunbar's number, interesting side note. But generally about 150 people or fewer, they're raising one another's kids together. You know, the kids call every woman mom and every man dad. You know, they're very intimate relationships. So yes, they were having sex with more than one person at a time. That's virtually certain, judging by the evidence that I've seen. But it wasn't cheap, casual, you know, go to a bar, meet someone, have sex, never see them again kind of sex, right? These are people who were very close to one another, who were very interdependent.
Talk about a little bit more about the what I take as the inner civil war between the chimp and the bonobo inside each of us.
If you go to a zoo and you're looking at a chimp or a bonobo in a cage, consider the fact that you're more closely related to that animal than that animal is to anything else in the zoo. A chimp or a bonobo is more closely related to a human than an Indian elephant is to an African elephant. We're extremely, in terms of DNA, last common ancestor, all the scientific ways of judging these things, we're extremely closely related. In fact, Jared Diamond, in one of his books, argues that really, scientifically speaking, we're three subspecies of chimpanzee. So the bonobo is wonderful, peaceful. No bonobo has ever been witnessed to kill or rape another bonobo. There's never been a case, a witness case, to infanticide. This is in captivity or in the wild in over 50 years of quite intense observation. Whereas the chimps are very, can be very aggressive, can be aggressive in an organized way that some primatologists refer to as war, where one band will attack another band and kill the males to take over their territory and all this sort of thing. But even with chimpanzees, I think that argument is quite overstated by people like Steven Pinker and others who argue for the primate origins of warfare. Because what you find, for example, in the most famous case of Jane Goodall's work in Gombe, the first 12 years, I believe, that she was at Gombe observing the chimps, she never saw any of that sort of warfare. There were very few cases of one chimp maybe killing a young chimp or something like that. But the organized warfare and all that came about when she started supplying bananas in one place at one time of day. And that's when she started to observe lots of aggression, much more coalitional conflict between groups of males, other groups coming in and attacking the local group and so on. So what did she do? She created an agricultural situation among those chimps. She wasn't doing it on purpose, of course. She just thought it made more sense for observation to have the chimps come in.
Was it the competition for the bananas that you're positing as the cause of war?
It changed the ecological situation in a way that made war suddenly worthwhile, because there was a concentrated, predictable source of food. There was accumulated resources, we could say. If you've got a crate of bananas at 5 p.m. every day that springs open and the same place every day, it's predictable, then there's a reason to set up and stay there. So you find this in hunter-gatherer people as well. You know, there are two sort of classic divisions, immediate return hunter-gatherers and delayed return hunter-gatherers. Immediate return hunter-gatherers are nomadic. You eat pretty much what you caught or found today, because there's no refrigeration or anything like that. You're not storing food. But then you've got delayed return hunter-gatherers, like in the area around the Seattle, Vancouver, the Northwest, where even though they didn't really have agriculture, they did have predictable seasonal surplus of food, the salmon runs. And what you find is that those types of societies tend to be very warlike and aggressive. Why? Because there's something worth fighting over. There's something worth defending. They're smoking the salmon. They've got accumulated stores of salmon. So it's almost an agricultural situation.
How is monogamy as a cultural norm attached to the rise of agriculture?
Well, monogamy is essentially a way of assuring paternity. By the way, when we talk about monogamy, until very recently, I'm talking within the last couple of decades, we were really only talking about women. Women's sexual behavior. If you look at adultery in the Bible, you know, there's tons of male adultery, right? the only adultery anybody would get stoned for involved a married woman. Concubines, slaves, unmarried women, do what you want, right? There's no problem there. It says, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his house, nor his ox, nor his slaves, nor his she-ass, etc. So it's, don't covet thy neighbor's stuff. Part of his stuff is his wife, right? So the connection between monogamy as control of women's sexuality and property is very essential and profound. The reason is paternity certainty, that men want to know that those children are his, right? I want to know those kids are mine. Why? Because I'm leaving my farm. I'm leaving my she-ass. I'm leaving my ox. I'm leaving all my stuff to those kids. So the essential importance of paternity certainty, we argue in Sex at Dawn, relates to property rights, okay, not to human nature. Because if you don't have any property or all the property is shared among the group, then who gives a damn whose kids those are, biologically speaking?
So is there a way to have a society in which we have property rights and private property, but we don't enforce the norms of monogamy and the nuclear family?
Well, sure. I mean, we've got birth control, right? So we no longer need to control a woman's sexual behavior to assure paternity. We no longer need to marry a virgin to be sure that any children she produces subsequently will be ours. You know what I mean? All these things, you know, date back to a time when there were no DNA tests, there were no condoms, there was no birth control pill. All these things didn't exist. So the only way to assure paternity was to have absolute control over a woman's behavior. And we still see this sort of behavior in these sorts of social structures in many parts of the world.
But there's no necessary connection between private property and monogamy?
No, not at this point, certainly.
Because of technology?
Because of technology, inheritance laws, yeah, birth control, yeah.
Why is that important for us? Why does it matter in our lives today?
Because we're all perverts. Sexuality is a very important part of most people's lives. And a very important part of intelligence is an attraction to novelty, right? We like new kinds of music, we like new shows, new movies, new colors, new art. You know, we're always interested in novelty because it's interesting. It's inherently interesting to intelligent beings. That applies to our sexuality as well. This stuff is important because it takes away the guilt, it takes away the shame. It shows that this attraction to novelty is certainly natural. Homosexuality, once you understand that sex isn't about reproduction, then suddenly the argument that homosexuality is God didn't intend it because it doesn't create babies, well, that's an empty argument. That's no argument at all. Most sex doesn't create babies. 99.99% of sex doesn't create babies, right? So I think if we could subvert this assumption that sex is about creating babies, then suddenly a lot of things start to fall apart, things that deserve to fall apart, in my opinion. I certainly don't mean to say when I argue that, attraction to novelty and all that, I'm not saying that there's no sexual behavior that should be condemned. You know, there certainly are. I mean, rape and pedophilia and all sorts of, any sort of coercive sexual behavior is to be condemned, I think. But whether or not these things are natural, it's very complicated to say. You know, one of the interesting differences between men and women involves erotic plasticity. So there's some interesting research using devices that measure genital blood flow that seems to indicate that men know what turns them on and women often don't. Women, there will often be a schism between, or a split between how their body is responding to something, whether it be a video or images or whatever, or a story, and what she will report consciously. It doesn't mean she's necessarily lying. It's just that her ability to gauge how her body's responding to things isn't always as clear as it is for most males.
What's your position on jealousy? If I feel jealous, what should I think about that?
Well, I think you should think about the source of your insecurity, right? I think jealousy is an expression of insecurity and fear. And in that sense, sure, it's natural, right? All animals feel fear of losing something that's valuable to them, whether it's a shelter or
their life.
Zebra they just killed, or their life, or their mate, or whatever. You know, so in that extent, it's natural. But the way different societies minimize or amplify that response. So you've got some societies like the Mosuo we talk about in southwestern China, who hold that sexual jealousy or any kind of move toward possession of another person or control of another person is seen as pathetic and ridiculous and highly offensive. So in that society, you don't see much of that. You just see very little of that. Whereas in societies like ours, I think our society plays that up, plays up the possession, because it's congruent with our economic and social structures.
I can imagine that some people would criticize your book as being simply an excuse for people like Anthony Weiner.
The book is about authenticity, it's about open communication, it's about coming out of the closet, whatever your closet happens to be, and facing who we are as individuals and as a species, starting from that sort of authenticity, whether it's in our marriage or in just in our own essence. Know thyself, right? Socrates. So certainly our book is not at all about giving excuses to cheaters and liars. There are a lot of marriages in which these sorts of agreements have been made and there is some integrity and authenticity within the marriage. If a public person's in that sort of a marriage and something comes up, I would just love to see someone say on 60 Minutes or on the nightly news or whatever, it's nobody's business. My wife knows, my kids know, everybody knows. I've got nothing to be ashamed of. We all love each other. What's your problem? I'm looking forward to a day where people will say, you know what? The people I love, the people I know who know me, have no problem with the way I'm living my life. If you do, then don't vote for me, or don't buy my product, or don't watch me golf, or whatever it is. That's your decision. But I'm okay with the way I'm living my life. For some people, that means strictly enforced monogamy. For other people, it doesn't. One of the great things I learned when researching the book, I went to find the first example of mate swapping behavior or open marriages in the U.S. And I thought it was going to be hippies, you know. And in fact, I found that it was World War II fighter pilots who had the highest fatality rates of any division of the military. When they were back on base, they had these key parties where they would sleep with one another's wives. And in interviews with these people, what we found was that they said it wasn't really about sex. We could have sex with anyone we wanted. You know, we were fighter pilots, and their wives and girlfriends were obviously very attractive people. These are all top guns, right? The reason they were doing this was to create bonds, affiliation, love among the group, because 25% of these guys didn't survive the war. And they knew they were facing those odds. And they knew that if they didn't come home, their buddies would take care of their wives and children, because they had developed this love and trust. And that, to me, echoed so closely with the evidence of our ancestors, that sex isn't just about pleasure. It's not just about getting off. It's about establishing trust, commitment, understanding, social bonds that keep us alive. That's what we do better than any other species. What is the natural state of human beings to be is similar to saying, what's the natural state of H2O, right? It depends. We can be a solid under some pressure and temperature. We can be a liquid. We can be a gas. You know, it depends. So I think we certainly are capable. There's no question that we're capable of extreme violence and cruelty, right? But we're also capable of extreme generosity and kindness. To me, I look at our society and I say, wow, there's an awful lot of training for violence. There's an awful lot of social pressure to move us toward the violent edge of the scale. And one of the things, one of the most effective ways of making a society violent is to be very restrictive of sexuality, by the way. Interesting, particularly for adolescent males. There's all sorts of research there. you know, and everyone talks about the fact that, you know, you can kill all the people you want on TV, you just can't have sex with one. You know, that there's something interesting going on there in terms of the way that what we present to children and adults even. But for me, one of the interesting things is, you know, there's nobody's walking around suffering from PTSD because they helped a stranger, right? But we've got all these veterans coming back from these pointless wars we send them off to, suffering lifelong debilitating mental illness because of the things they saw or did. That tells me something, right? Chimps don't get PTSD because they ripped a monkey apart. So if Steven Pinker and others are going to say we're much more like chimps, how do they explain PTSD? How do they explain, you know, the extreme suffering that results in most cases from being cruel to other human beings? You know, even psychopaths, there aren't a lot of psychopaths, but what we generally find with pedophilia and other forms of extreme aggression is that those people are victims. They were victims as children. They're not typical healthy individuals who go off and do these things. So, yeah, human nature is variable, but I do think that all things being considered, we tend to align much more with bonobos.
So we can make love and not war.
Well, I think the more love we make, the less war we'll make.
But you are hopeful.
I'm hopeful, yes. And it seems that the arc of history is... you know, it points toward greater freedom and acceptance. Certainly in the last 10, 15 years, we've seen acceptance of same-sex marriage just go from one end of the spectrum to the other. So I think the momentum is with us, yes.
Well, good. Well, thank you very much for joining us. I want to thank Christopher Ryan for being with us today. For Reason TV, I'm Thad Russell.